Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. Today's Thursday, and James Corbett will be joining Alfred Addisk just after the first segment today. So we're going to get started right away in this first segment of the program. We're going to bring you, or I'm going to bring you, the market for September 4th, 2014. And by the way, it's a beautiful day here in central Pennsylvania, and absolutely beautiful. More of a summer day than a almost fall. And I guess we turn back our clocks this weekend. So make sure you jot down on your calendar. I'm pretty sure it's this weekend that we turn back our clocks. Turn back the hands of time this weekend. But for gold, we were able to turn back about $6.70 today at $1,263. We had a high of $1,278. It was off strong after the ECB came out with their moves, with their discussions, with their rate decreases. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. But it reversed. I'd say gold reversed here in the last half hour. Silver was down 11 cents today at 1916, along with platinum down two at 1409. However, we saw a big move in palladium today, kind of went against the grain, so maybe that's a leading indicator for gold and silver tomorrow. Palladium was up $16 at $891, so interesting to see that type of a move in palladium for I'm not quite sure why. I'll have to dig a little deeper there. However, the USDX today responded much stronger today, 0.89 to the upside. In fact, that's even off the high of the day for the index, 83.75. And of course, you can only imagine what the euro did. It did break down into the 129 area. Crude oil today was also down a buck at 94.51. Paper markets today all had bigger openings, but they all reversed. And you have the Dow, basically very small changes in the markets. The Dow was down 8, the NASDAQ down 10, and the S&P down 5. So not a lot of there. But the 10-year yield is moving up 0.04 at 2.45%. So a little interesting there. You didn't see any. Yeah, we did see the. You'd think you'd have a bigger reaction in the yields for the 10-year. But we'll see how it plays out tomorrow. This is a short week of trade. Still a lot of folks on vacation from the Labor Day weekend. And I believe next week, beginning first day of trading next week, is a full moon too. So you know what happens when those full moon is out, everyone begins to howl and do crazy things. So maybe we'll see a crazy day in the markets come Monday. But you know, it's a slow news day when the biggest headlines is demonstrations for the fast food people. Their minimum wage idea is $15 an hour, and also the death of Joan Rivers. But we'll talk about the demonstrators a little bit after this first. We're going to talk about the European Central Bank, their attack on deflation, trying to drive down the euro, because weaker currencies are is always better for trades for countries. And it makes you wonder how, you know, we gave them the idea of how to do things from the playbook of Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve, and certainly they're following suit. And everyone says this was a surprise rate cut and major policy announcement. Well, I didn't think it was any big surprise or any major policy announcement. We've been talking about it and reading about it here for the past, I saw from the first of this week. And certainly we understand that the problems the Eurozone is having, the countries are not doing well, no matter how long ago they said, oh, we're having a great economy. It's turning around, but not so true. And again, you had the euro that fell to the lowest level for more than a year against the dollar. And Mario Draghi came out and he unveiled plans to buy asset-backed securities, the ABS, to help kickstart lending in the euro region. And, of course, they're looking at a program to purchase covered bonds. Now, if you remember this technique, it's buying certain types of assets out of the bank balance sheets, and you replace them with cash. So they buy up all the toxic assets of these banks. Supposedly all these banks are in such great shape. They pass all their stress tests and everything like that. So you wouldn't think that they would need help. But their idea and their commentary is in hope that it's going to this cash will be used to be passed on in the form of loans. And we also see that that doesn't really work because we're really not experiencing a lot of that here in the States. And they say this is just the ECB shock to the markets. And I don't think the markets were really shocked at all. But that's what these reporters and analysts are talking about. And we knew it'd be just a matter of time before Europe did the same thing. And this move, there's comments that this move shows that how eager the Euro Central Bank is to encourage the banks to lend again. They see negative deposit rates as an alternative way to improve inflation levels. So again, this is another sign government wants and government needs inflation. So they like higher inflation rates, and they like low currencies and greater inflation levels, and of course the two work together. The IMF fund, Christine Lagarde, she welcomed the new measures, and she said in a statement that they would help counter low inflation. And I remember it wasn't too long ago that she had said that the United States, if we followed along those same program that we've been following for Ben Bernanke, that our government, our country would be in serious trouble. Our structures would be in trouble. So, but now she's welcoming these new measures for the European Union. And so by the end of the day, they got what they wanted. The Paris clock, their markets were up by 1.65%. Frankfurt's, the DAX was up over 1%. And so again, they were scared of deflation and they want higher inflation. The ECB also went on today and they cut their central refinancing rate to 0.05%, and that's from 0.15%. So they're almost at 0% along the same path as Japan has done for so many years. It also lowered the deposit rate. I mean, you're already in negative territory. So now they're going to give you a double whammy. And they're lowering the deposit rate to negative 0.20% from 0.10%, and trimmed its marginal lending rate to 0.30% to 0.40%. So, yeah, you put in $100,000 1 month, and you get your statement, and it's negative. It comes in at the $99,000 instead of the $100,000 that you put in. So nothing like a negative deposit rate to encourage depositors to put your money in there. But the government's in there giving them the money, so... Hey, when you have the government backing you like these something like these banks do, what do you have to worry about? You know, they'll be there. They'll be there to help the politicians change the laws so, you know, you can do the bail-ins and, you know, take people's money. I mean, hey, that's what you get for keeping your money in the banks nowadays. And if you haven't been warned, I don't know how else to warn folks. We keep talking about it, how dangerous it is. And there isn't. People tell me, what do you do with your cash? I don't want to keep it in the bank. So what's the next best thing? It's even better than cash. And, of course, that's gold. But you might also see the European Union cut the rates again. And certainly if Germany's growth continues to be hit with the conflict with Ukraine and Russia, as one of the, you know, main reason, or not the main reason, but it certainly has a major impact on Germany's economy through this time, you might see them cut rates again. And in some other news, you had BP, the oil giant. Their stocks tumbled nearly 6% today. There was a U.S. judge that ruled that the massive 2010 Gulf of Mexico oil spill was due to the company's gross negligence. So now they're really opening up the oil giant to billions and billions of dollars in additional fines, and couldn't happen to a nicer group, certainly if there was negligence. And I do know many people lost their wages, their shipping, their fishing, their life. They had to change things, and of course that's another story that I haven't heard anybody talk about that lately, and certainly not what the true damage to that oil spill and how it changed so much. And I can't remember his name, so I shouldn't even bring him up, but the gentleman who I know, if Frank's listening, he knows who I'm talking about. Peak Oil, the Peak Oil guy, he was actually going to make some sort of an announcement in regards to this oil spill and the BP. And, of course, I think the day before, the 2 days before that he was to make this announcement to release some sort of a paper, I believe he drowned in his hot tub. So you never know, folks. You just never, never know. So slow news day, a little pressure on gold. You know, we'll see what happens. Interest has certainly picked up in the purchasing of gold and silver. It was a quiet summer. We did have the summer doldrums, certainly for the precious metals. And people just don't know what to do. You know, they see stock markets hitting all-time highs. They see the dollar getting stronger, and they see gold as struggling under the pressure of manipulation. And but there really isn't anything else, folks. You bring me a better idea of where people can put their money, and I'd be happy to listen and see what we can do. But there really isn't any other place in my mind. We had the minimum wage demonstrations today. People got handcuffed in cities around the country today. They, you know, blocked traffic, and they're trying to get noticed. And these are people that work at McDonald's, Burger King, and other fast food companies, and they want $15 an hour. Now, what's interesting to me is these protests, they're planned by labor organizations, organizers, and I think, I can't remember the actual union group, but it is unions. It is a union who is organizing these demonstrations, and they're actually calling for disobedience. They want these people to become disruptive and to be arrested. And it's like, well, what is wrong with that picture? Here they're encouraging people. That should be, that's wrong. And it's backed by the Service Employees International Union. That's the union that's backing, that financially is backing this movement. And we've seen these protests. They began in late 2012. And, you know, they change their tactics every few months. So just to keep the attention on these protests. And I really don't think anybody really cares. But, you know, when you encourage civil disobedience, that's wrong. And so I think instead of arresting the demonstrators, they should arrest the organizers and the people in from this union. Those are the ones who should be arrested. And certainly we all know when it comes to minimum wage, it's more or less a political statement. We have elections coming up here in the next couple of months. So this all brings attention, and we'll see how quickly this is dropped after the election. And certainly President, I'm not even going to call him president, but Obama, he certainly had to make his statement. He said he'd join a union. It's like when all of a sudden he became a union lover. And but he, again, he's pushing Congress to raise the minimum wage. And they quoted these two people. Here's this one guy. No, I'm sorry, and I don't mean to be tacky or anything, but here they hold one of these guys away, Tyree Johnson. He says he earns $8.45 an hour after working at a Chicago McDonald's for more than two decades. He's been there for 22 years, and he can't help his family. It's like, well, if you worked at McDonald's for 22 years and you've accepted $8.45, I'd say your personal initiative is pretty low. I mean, come on. I mean, you can go to school, you can do other things, you can get another job, you can work two jobs. I remember when I was young, I'll work two and three jobs and went to school. If one job wasn't paying enough, I got another job. But you don't see that today. And certainly it is a sign of the times. It is certainly a sign of our jobs leaving this country and what has been left for places for people to work. And certainly $8.45 is not a lot, not with inflation and everything. But folks, they're certainly not worth $15 an hour for a fast food restaurant. And I'll tell you what, it's true, and Frank had made a comment, it's easy to move up in these companies into management. It's fairly easy. And they have all kinds of programs you can go to. And so again, you know, if you want to work at McDonald's for 22 years, I'd say that's your choice. And there was another one quoted also, you know, talking about how they can't afford their family for working at these places. Well, better yourself. Go get another job. You know, if you have to work 60 hours a week to pay for your family, then do it. I've done it. So, and I'm sure many of you listeners have done it also. And what they're going to do is they're eventually going to be replaced. I know we've talked about this on this program before. We're robots. They're going to replace them anyway. So they're out there demonstrating for $15 an hour. They're out there demonstrating for $15 an hour only to get replaced by robots here in the near future. And we talked about this before, and I think it was one of the fast food Panera Bread. They're spending millions and millions. I think it's like $45 million to develop a new system to replace people. So, you know, hey, technology is great. People embraced it. Everyone in this country has embraced technology. And look what it's going to do. It's going to eliminate jobs. It's going to eliminate, it's taken over our lives. And it's I believe more harm has been done by the internet than good. And I get argued with that every moment. People will tell me all the time, you're wrong. And I don't think so. But I do think there is a break and I need to get out of here. 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Alfred Adask and James Corbett will be joining you after the break. And we'll be back tomorrow with David Krieger from Hobson Metals. We'll
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97%. Of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adask, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. While your gold and silver coin needs, our guest is James Corbett. He's the author of The Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. And James has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started The Corbett Report in 2007. As an outlet for independent, critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. And I don't think it's kind of interesting to me to do these programs just from the perspective. I keep wondering if I can pose a question that James might not be able to respond to with a great deal of knowledge and intellect. And so far, hasn't happened. James knows not a little about a lot of things. He seems to know a lot about a lot of things. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, Alfred, but you may be in luck tonight. You may be able to stump me as I am running on 2 hours of sleep. So we'll see.
All right. Well, I'll try not to take advantage of having only 2 hours of sleep. But here's one. Japan seeks to resume Antarctic whaling next year. Japan is seeking international support for its plans to hunt minke whales in the Antarctic Ocean next year by scaling down the whaling research program the UN top court rejected earlier last year. Whaling, for research purposes, is exempt from the 1986 international ban on commercial whaling, and Japan has conducted hunts in the Atlantic and Pacific on that basis. In other words, They've been conducting, if I understand the story, they've been hunting whales under the pretext of doing research, which is apparently no limit on whales that are harvested for research. So the question is, what is this thing Japan has with whales? Are they addicted to these creatures, or what is the explanation for Japan's appetite for whale. Can you give us some insight into that?
Well, yes. I mean, I can certainly attest to the fact that it is a just a cultural legacy here that the Japanese do eat whale. And yes, the idea that they're doing this for scientific purposes is on its face ludicrous, because this whale meat that they're catching for this quote unquote scientific research is sold in shops and restaurants. And I can attest of the fact that I worked in the public school system here for a number of years, and they do serve school lunches here. And it was the second or third year that I was eating these school lunches that I finally realized, oh, that thing that I don't know what that is, oh, that's whale. So I have eaten whale numerous times, and it's served to school children. It's absolutely nothing to do with scientific research, except I suppose long-term food population effects or something of that sort. So it is, I mean, they're obviously just trying to skirt the rules with this, and it's I think unfortunate because of obviously some of the other things that go along with this, including the dolphin hunting and things of that nature that are just grotesque. And I don't think Japan is going to give it up easily or without a fight.
I understand. What are the Japanese people, are they concerned about the extinction of whales? Does that concern them at all? Is there any movement where they think this is something to be concerned about? Or do they just say, you know, let's get a whale burger for lunch?
Yeah. Well, I think it's more of the latter than the former. There's obviously, there are elements here, environmentalists and people who are concerned about that, but I think the mainstream of the population just kind of goes along with it. It's not exactly like it's an everyday meal. I mean, even in the school lunches, it's only maybe once a year or so that the kids will get it, but, you know, everyone does eat it when they're growing up. And,
it's kind of,
you know, it's just part of the culture.
Thanksgiving?
Yeah. Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah. All right. I've got another one here, different subject. Ukraine needs another $19 billion from the International Monetary Fund. This is from Ms. Shedlock at Global Economic Trend Analysis. And he points out that the Ukraine, they've already collected almost $17 billion from the IMF. And now they're going to need another $19 billion if this war is going to continue. The skirmish over the Ukraine is going to continue throughout 2015. And my question is, would there be any significant wars if there weren't credit? You understand? We go into debt every time. Mm. Every war generates enormous debt. And what I'm wondering is, could there be significant number of wars if we didn't have credit? It's shoot now, pay later. That's the formula for war in the 20th century, now in the 21st century. What if it was cash and carry?
Well, you're exactly right about that. Not just the 20th or 21st century, but we can go back, I mean, at least to the 17th century, where the Bank of England was formed as a result of King William's predicament, where the British Navy had been wiped out in a naval defeat by the French. And in order to rebuild it, he had to go cap in hand to the bankers, and he offered to grant a charter to form the Bank of England, which then created that money that they lent to the British government, to the crown, to build the navy out of nothing. They just created the money out of nothing because they're a bank and they can do that. So this, I mean, this goes back a long ways. I'm sure it goes back much further before that even. And of course, this is how the Rothschild family came to prominence in Europe there in the 18th century. It was loaning to the crowns, to the kings of Europe at the time, in order to finance the various wars that were going on, and then, of course, continuing on through the 19th century. I mean, this is a very, very, very old phenomenon, and I think you're exactly right. I mean, if there was, I mean, this is one of the things to be said about a commodity currency, a hard currency, is that you can't just create it out of nothing. If you don't have it, you can't spend it, and without credit, obviously, the $1 trillion that were spent in Iraq in the last decade would not have been possible by a U.S. government that's obviously incapable of producing that money economically. So, yes, you're exactly right. I mean, credit does fuel war, and that's why, I mean, there is such a connection, a nexus between the people who provide this credit and the ability to fuel these wars. And it's interesting to think, of course, what is the very first thing that happened as soon as the Ukraine government was overthrown in that coup earlier this year. The very first pronouncement that the really American-installed puppet prime minister, Yatsenyuk, said was that we are fully prepared and fully committed to pledge ourselves to the IMF and whatever stipulations they put on any lending that they'll give us. Because obviously this entire crisis was really precipitated by Ukraine's terrible financial position. So again, finance leads to war. Finance finances war. Finance is what makes the world go round. And in a world that's run by gangsters, it's absolutely essential to fueling the sort of lifeblood of this gangster economy.
And you're suggesting that the link between credit and war is not merely one of convenience, and certainly not just coincidence, but you're at least, or perhaps you're suggesting that it goes much deeper. Is it possible that the big banks, their ability to issue credit, is to some degree dependent on war? Is that too far to speculate, or do you think that's possible? I mean, is the link, it's not, is it just convenience, or is war essential to a credit-based economy?
I guess it is possible to imagine an economy, a credit-based economy, that doesn't revolve around war. But war is absolutely the easiest way, I think, for the banksters to rack up those huge debts, right? The government indebted to them.
Possible, I mean, so to I imagine. It's like,
well, I'm just trying to think of this very theoretically.
We can conceive of this. I don't know if it's true or not, but we could conceive of it. Here's another one. Here's another one from Vladimir Putin. He warns Europe, I can take Kiev in 2 weeks. All right, you've probably seen the headline. Do you think President Putin regretted that statement after he made it? Could that statement be described as unhelpful? Or is Putin pretty much just saying, look, this is the way it is? Is he the kind of guy that just says, this is the way it is, and he's not making means what he says? What do you think?
Well, the interesting thing about that comment, as far as I know, is that it was said in a private conversation, or what was meant to be a private conversation with Barroso, the former European Commission president, or the current, I think he's just outgoing, European Commission President José Manuel Barroso, who was one of the architects of the Eurozone. And this was sort of leaked by Barroso. The contents of the call were not leaked, but he just basically said, Putin said, if I want to, I can take Kiev in 2 weeks. I mean, that's interesting because that's a huge breach of diplomatic protocol, usually, if that type of thing happens. So that's going to be a pretty major international and diplomatic incident. So that's interesting in and of itself. And then, I mean, the context of that statement, I mean, it could be a threat. I can take Kiev in 2 weeks if I wanted to. But I think it could, depending on the context, it could be equally well read in the exact opposite way. I could take Kiev in 2 weeks, but I haven't. So, you know, clearly I'm restraining myself. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of different ways that could be read. And unless we have the full context of that conversation, I don't think we know exactly what that means.
Well, he's essentially implying he could give Kiev a dose of shock and awe in 2 weeks. But he may have learned from the American lesson over in Iraq. We gave them a dose of shock and awe. And President Bush announced mission accomplished. And yet it took us another 8 years to get out of that thing. And I'm not sure we're out even now. And the point I'm making, you might be able to take it in 2 weeks, but can you hold it? You know, there's some countries countries that you just this more trouble than this could ever be worth.
Well, that's exactly the point. And that's why, I mean, what Putin has really talked about in recent weeks openly is the idea, he's floated the idea of some sort of Eastern Ukrainian state, an actual separation of Eastern Ukraine and recognition of statehood, which, I mean, I think ultimately would make a lot more sense than Russia trying to physically or militarily control Ukraine. Obviously, that would be a very different scenario and one that, as you say, would be extremely difficult to maintain. But to basically have that buffer state of an Eastern Ukraine that's really more Russian than Ukrainian, I think would definitely certainly play into what Putin wants to come out of this situation and would provide that buffer zone that obviously wouldn't be privy to joining the NATO alliance that's slowly encircling Russia at this point.
I think one of the lessons here is that increasingly people are going to be able to name and decide their own nations. As crazy as that sounds, you would think we're coming, a lot of people think we're coming to a single global, homogenous nation, perhaps, with a new world order. I'm not sure if a lot of people think that, but it's at least conceivable. But what I'm getting to, are we reaching a time where it's possible, increasingly possible, for a particular vicinity that just has the same language, same cultural values, same race, say, that's it, we're starting our own company. We're starting our own state. And if there's enough of them and they really are dedicated, can that happen? Is that something that's increasingly likely in this world, or can they expect to be crushed and forced back into, you know, the greater, whatever superior organization they're currently associated with? Do you see what I'm saying there?
I really do, and you raise a really important and interesting point, because it really does seem paradoxical, this thrust towards globalization and centralization, at the same time that there's this increasing move towards the sort of what looks like decentralization of all these these ethnicities and nationalities trying to sort of reclaim their own territories and states. But I actually see them, those two processes going hand in hand, because I think that the common denominator here is that the bulwark against globalization has, to this point, been the nation-state idea itself. And obviously, in America, there's a lot of, you know, American patriotic sentiment that has always acted as a roadblock towards the League of Nations and then the United Nations from ever impinging too much on American sovereignty, although, of course, that process has gradually eroded American sovereignty over the decades. But still, I mean, you know, the American nation-state has been a bulwark against that. But in this process where we see this increasing breaking apart of countries, I think they are more privy then to be subsumed into regional entities. So that you, I mean, for example, if you have something like a Quebec separating from Canada or Scotland separating from Great Britain, what you're going to have almost necessarily, and I would certainly hope this could be avoided, but I don't think it could be, is it's that entity, that smaller carved out state, is going to have its sovereignty and its parliament and whatever, but it's going to be immediately subsumed in some sort of relationship with it, the greater mother entity that it spawned from, and from the entities around it. So that, for example, with the Scottish referendum that's coming up very shortly here about Scottish independence, the EU is now already issuing threats of various sorts. Basically, if Scotland tries to break apart from the Bank of England and does not have a central bank that in some way, you know, corresponds to what the EU wants, then it can't join the Eurozone and things of that nature. So, I mean, not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but basically they're trying to hold some sort of threat over Scotland and say, you know, you can have your own parliament, you can have your own, you know, nation, but don't try to get out of the system. Don't try to fundamentally buck the system. So I think that there is this move towards making people feel better because, oh, you have your nation and it's your nation and you have a parliament and whatever. But I think ultimately that's just to break everyone apart in order to sort of scoop up the pieces into that greater whole. And the regional framework, or eventually the global framework, will be the overarching system, but it won't be necessarily that, you know, there will be the seat of power in wherever, Washington or Tel Aviv or Rome or wherever it ends up being, and everyone, you know, hails to it. Everyone will feel like they have their own regional government, which is theirs and the one that they correspond to. But in reality, the underlying financial infrastructure and the political infrastructure will, I think, be tied together in that whole. So it's a paradoxical system of breaking apart in order to put those pieces into a more coherent whole.
You're saying that there may be more of an illusion of independence, and that the illusion might be sufficient to keep people happy.
That's the risk,
think
anyway.
You're politically independent, even though, no, really, you're not. But
yeah,
it's an interesting world, interesting times, and there are things that are difficult to understand. We're also, the other thing that we're implicating here is just divide and conquer. I live in Texas. People in Texas talk about leaving the Union. I can imagine that people in the New World Order would like to see that happen. They'd like to see Texas pulled out of the United States and broken down, break this country down into small enough chunks, it no longer becomes a threat to the New World Order. We're going to take a break for some commercial announcements. I'll be back with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com in just a moment. Please stay tuned.
Denied internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a KU band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
I'm Alfred Adask, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. My guest is James Corbett of The Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. We've been talking about what's been going on in Kiev, Russia. Let's move over to the Middle East a little bit. Got an article, and you've everyone seen it. Islamic State issues video of beheading of U.S. hostage. The Islamic State militant group released a video on Tuesday purporting to show the beheading of a second American hostage, journalist Stephen Sotloff. Now, President Obama has responded. He said he's going to degrade and destroy Islamic State. Now, that's interesting. I mean, that's interesting language coming from the president. And the point, my question to you, has the Islamic State gone too far? Are they now being recognized as something, not just some rebels who'd like to change the government? Are they being recognized almost universally as some sort of a monster or monsters that need to be stomped out? What do you think? Have they gone too far or not?
I just really can't take this seriously at face value the way that it's being portrayed, that that ultimately this is a case of Islamic militants who are attempting to provoke the West or what have you. I really do just see this as part of the war on terror script that we've seen unfolding for the past decade and a half now. And this is just another version of that. Now that the Al-Qaeda boogeyman is more or less off the table, there's the ISIS boogeyman to fill that role. And as a result, I mean, we start seeing these beheading videos, which even UK experts in the UK, the London Times, were talking about how the last video was staged and there were elements of it that were clearly faked. So I haven't looked deeply into this latest video, but apparently it doesn't show the actual beheading like the other video didn't either. So again, I think there will be similar questions about, you know, what's going on here and are these videos being staged? Are they going too far? I mean, no, I really do think this is just part of a larger plot to try to get the American public, certainly to get behind military intervention and other publics besides the UK. I just saw a Twitter poll going by Sky News recently that showed 83% of Twitter respondents want a armed intervention by the UK in order to get ISIS. So I think this propaganda is having a startling and wonderful effect for the defense contractors and the banks that, as we were just talking about, do rely on this type of provocation. And as I wrote about in the most recent International Forecaster, or last week's International Forecaster, I was writing about how this is just part of a pattern that really does seem to come up every single year in the 6 weeks or so preceding the 9/11 anniversary, in which there is every single year without fail some sort of terror warning, some sort of incident with plane crashes and something to do with airplane or airline security. There's all of these sort of 9/11 trigger stories that seem to come up like clockwork, starting around July, August, culminating and peaking in September, and then fizzling away by October. So I certainly hope this will follow that pattern, but it certainly does seem that this year the rhetoric is even more just insane, off the charts, than it has been before. And whatever threat this group actually does or does not pose in reality, it's certainly having an effect in terrorizing the American population via the true terrorists, who are the people in the positions of power who have the ability to respond to this responsibly, or to respond to it by cranking up the fear dial to 11. And that's exactly what they're doing right now, with the defense secretary giving a joint press conference with the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, talking about the end of days vision of this group and how they're set on annihilating, you know, all opposition. And you have Republican senators coming out saying they're determined to blow up a city. So I definitely see this as part of a terror campaign that's aimed at the psyche of the American people and Western countries generally, in order to ramp them up into a war hysteria once again.
Well, we'll watch and see. We may be going back to the Middle East with a fresh coat of paint on our tanks. We'll see how this works out. Let's go on to, here's something, Wealth of Nations was Adam Smith's observation about how wealth was created. And he postulated that there was an invisible hand that guided people in the free markets. And later economists focused on prices, and one thing led to another. Among the phenomena that these proto-economists discovered were Say's Law and Gresham's Law. I'm not sure if you're familiar with these. I expect that you probably are. I'll be surprised if you're not, to tell you the truth. But for the benefit of our audience, French businessman and economist Jean-Baptiste Say discovered that products are paid for with products, not merely with money. He meant that you needed to produce things to buy things. You could not just produce money. Do you think Say's Law is still in effect, or has the Federal Reserve rescinded that law?
Well, I think, like any universal law, that law cannot be rescinded, but it can perhaps be delayed in the same way that maybe a rocket booster can kind of delay the effects of gravity. But as soon as that pull is ceased, that the gravity will kick in once again, and the object will attract as usual. So I think in this case, the upward momentum of the stock markets, for example, is being given that boost by the rocket boosters of the quantity quantitative easing, the flooding of the money into the economy and specifically into the equities markets. But again, once that rocket booster runs out of juice and starts to descend, it will bring everything back down with it. I think it's exactly true to this day. I mean, if you do not have a productive economy in some manner, in some function, then unless you are simply expanding at the point of a gun, taking over places that do have productive economic capacity, you are going to suffer that at some point. There's going to be a collapse. And I think that's, as we've been documenting here for many weeks, I think that's where we're heading in this current round of quantitative easing boosted hyperinflationary craziness that's going on in the markets. And in fact, this is not an opinion of Joe Schmo or, you know, James Corbett. This is an opinion of billionaires, as Zero Hedge has an interesting post up today pointing out that billionaires such as Sam Zell and George Soros and Carl Icahn and Stan Druckenmiller are all right now talking about how overinflated the markets are, how they fear a plunge is coming, how the fact that this has been completely detached from economic reality. For example, Sam Zell quoted as saying, "I don't remember any time in my career where there have been as many wild cards floating out there that have the potential to be very significant and alter people's thinking. People have no place else to put their money, and the stock market is getting more than its share. It's very likely that something has to give here." A lot of statements like that floating around because, I mean, economic reality is economic reality. 2 + 2 = 4. And if all you have to produce is money, paper promises, then at some point those paper promises are going to come home to roost and the house of cards is going to collapse.
When we say that there's no place else to invest your money right now, people are investing in the American stock markets because they've got no better place to go. Does that only apply within the United States, for example? Does it apply globally? And if it applies globally, does this reflect diminished demand? Why can't I put my money into a local factory? Why can't I find a place to invest my money? Is it because even the factories aren't doing well? Diminished demand in the context of a global recession, and therefore there's no place to invest. If you've got money, where are you going to put it?
That is absolutely, I think, one of the very big questions right now. And there are people who are looking for returns in various foreign markets in developing countries. But as we saw in the last couple of years, that is very much, again, contingent on what's going on with specifically with American quantitative easing in the Federal Reserve. And we saw when the Federal Reserve started to push on the brake and ease off the gas pedal last year, we started to see some of the effect shaking out in India and other places where we saw some of that money flooding out of their markets. And we saw the collapse of the rupee last year. So it absolutely is a system that's connected through quantitative easing of various sorts and in various places. And you ask the question, is this specifically an American phenomenon? It certainly isn't, because, I mean, as we have been documenting here as well, the Bank of Japan has done a very similar thing in the last couple of years that has similarly inflated the Nikkei index. The European Central Bank is constantly talking about how they're prepared to buy any amount of bonds. They're prepared to flood any amount of QE into the European economy. That has not had a significant buoyant effect on the European markets as of yet, but they haven't actually really pulled that trigger yet. It certainly seems that they are preparing for a round of European quantitative easing, so we'll see if that takes place. But I think a lot of central banks are looking at what the U.S. Federal Reserve has done and how it's buoyed the markets up to all-time record highs, and they're thinking about trying to do the exact same thing. So I think we have to be wary of the fact that this is an idea that's going to spread and probably play out in a lot of different places around the world before it ultimately starts to collapse.
When talk about a collapse, people talk about the U.S. dollar perhaps becoming worthless. It loses its status of world reserve currency. It's slowly declining as world reserve currency. It doesn't dominate the markets to the extent that it did in the past. But on the other hand, it still dominates the markets. How long can the dollar hold together? And will the dollar, is it going to be the last fiat currency to go? Will all the weaker fiat currencies have to fold up before the dollar finally collapses? Or is the dollar the linchpin, the one currency that when it goes, then all the rest of the fiat currencies follow? Or will some fiat currencies survive quite nicely without the dollar? What do you think?
Well, I certainly do think of the dollar as a linchpin. And when and if the dollar were to collapse, I think that would set off just a tidal wave of calamity around the world, because the entire world financial infrastructure has been based on the dollar. And certainly some places might do better and fare relatively better than other places. But I think that it would be turmoil and chaos, and it probably would not play out very well for 99.999% of the population of the globe. So clearly the dollar is a linchpin, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that linchpin has to be the first thing to go. It certainly could be a tidal wave in the other direction of some of these peripheral economies collapsing and causing a tidal wave that goes inwards towards that linchpin. And that is, it's a possibility that depending how that plays out, the American dollar in the American economy could ultimately end up being the winner simply by being the best house in a bad neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
And
I understand.
That's something that I've discounted quite a bit. But I saw recently an interview of Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who writes for The Telegraph, being interviewed by Lars Scholl, in which he says that American economic power is, in fact, right now at its zenith. It's never been stronger. And I had to think about that, and looking at the system the way it is right now, it may actually even be true. It doesn't mean that there aren't systemic risks to that system, but certainly just the way the European economy is in the doldrums, the way China is slowing down precipitously, the way a lot of these developing nations are failing to live up to the hype that had surrounded them for the past decade, the way, as I say, Europe and Russia are obviously being taken off of the economic table. There really is no major competitor to America right now. So disregarding the actual American instability, I think that looking at everyone else, relatively speaking, American economic power remains certainly very strong right now. So it is conceivable that in some way this system, even if it does go through a change of some sort, may in fact still have America at the top of that pyramid. And that's a possibility which I hadn't taken seriously enough before. But of course, it is one of the cards on one of the ways that the cards could play out, depending how they land on the table.
Yeah, we definitely live in interesting times. If the United States manages to maintain its position through, is this divine providence, dumb luck, or are there actually people in Washington who have brains enough to orchestrate what you're suggesting might happen? If we take everybody else down, do we wind up winning the game? Not because we're necessarily exactly better, but we knock them all down and we're the last one standing. Dumb luck or a grace of God or somebody up there smart enough to move in that direction?
Well, I'm not one of those people who says that every single thing that happens in the world is planned ahead of time and that it's all part of some great plan. But having said that, I think that we are also at our level of living in everyday life with everyday sort of normal people. I think we fail to understand the sort of Machiavellian nature of the people in these positions of power and how seriously they take those positions and how painstakingly they work towards implementations of plans that sometimes take years, decades, or even generations to implement. Mm-hmm. And we can see that manifested through, the Rockefeller family is one I often turn to in the American context as one that has maintained and projected its power and influence over the American economy and the American political system for at least a century now, and continues to do so, and continues to spearhead the free trade area of the Americas and other such projects as their pet projects. I think
James,
we have to...
All right, well, you're going to have to give us a one-sentence conclusion.
I think we have to take that into account, the fact that there are people in positions of power who are working towards implementing goals. They may not be 100% effective, but they're certainly trying to do that. And I think we have to take that into account with our overall philosophy.
I didn't count. I think I only had one period in that sentence, but it was a long one. This is James Corbett. I want to thank you for being on the program again, James. We look forward to talking to you again next week. Folks, thank you for listening. I'm Alfred Addisk. This is Financial Survival. Be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Frank the producer, and James Corbett. Good night. ¶¶
work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.